This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. On today's podcast, I'm joined by Russell Moore, president of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and Tim Keller, senior pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, and co-founder and vice president of the Gospel Coalition.
Many evangelicals are angry, disheartened, fearful about the world their children will inhabit, let alone their grandchildren. Russell, how do you counsel them?
Well, I think the words of Jesus are instructive when he says, "Do not fear, little flock, for it's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." I think that every part of that is important. Little flock, the reality is that the church is hidden in the midst of the world. But we have confidence in the fact that the power of the gospel is moving us forward toward the kingdom. And so I think what sometimes happens with people who are overly fearful and angry is that they have this myth of decline where they assume that there was a time before where everything was set and it was right and we're losing it.
Probably the 50s.
The 50s or the 80s or the, you know, and I think it differs with different people, but there's a sense of desperation that comes because we're losing it. Rather than seeing the world as a fallen war zone from Eden to Armageddon, and that fallenness manifests itself in different ways at different points, and then to recognize God sovereignly put us here at this culture at this time and has given us all the resources for life and godliness. But that takes a pulling back consistently and self-examining and reminding oneself of that rather than just being caught in the whirl of what's happening.
Would you say the congregation at Redeemer is in any way fearful, Tim? Is this a pastoral concern for you about the future of Christianity in New York City in particular?
No, not exactly. But I mean, I think you do need to keep in mind that the situation which evangelicals right. in the South or the Midwest are finding themselves in now, in other words, the cultural climate, is something that Christians in places like, you know, Manhattan have been living in for 30 years.
Sure.
You moved and planted Redeemer.
Yes,
in that
right, right. It was already like this. Mm-hmm. And so in a certain sense, we're not experiencing the big shock, but we see the changes coming in the general culture, but there's a certain sense in which we haven't, it doesn't feel as much of a shock. I'd also add this. If you go back a few decades, the future doesn't look good for us. But you know, for lots and lots of places, the last 500 years, when the queen was Catholic,
yeah.
If you're Protestant, you couldn't have a government job.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't have an appointment to an academic appointment.
Right.
You certainly did not have a tax exempt status. I mean, and then when the king became Protestant, suddenly the Catholics were out and that
mm-hmm,
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the Jews, I'm just thinking of Britain, you know, in the mm-hmm, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s.
Right.
The Jews certainly were not able to, they couldn't get into to Oxford or Cambridge. They
right.
they couldn't teach there. They couldn't have government jobs. So many of the things that we're looking at as what I would call disaster scenarios are actually, when I go to meetings where they say, maybe it could be that people with evangelical convictions won't be able to have a job in government. We won't be able to keep our accreditation, or we won't be able to keep our tax-exempt status. And I keep thinking, well, there's an awful lot of other groups that did quite well under those circumstances, and they thrived and brought it together. It certainly wasn't easy. But we're really probably not facing things that haven't been faced before by religious communities, by Christian communities, that actually thrive quite well in those circumstances.
Even Christian communities in the West.
Yeah, we just need to get a little bit of a stark perspective on that sort of thing.
Depends on your frame of reference.
Well, yeah.
Tim, you've talked often about, I've heard you speak about a wisdom test.
Yeah.
That if we truly believe that God has designed this world a certain way, then living out of accordance with that plan is going to lead to great hardship. And we see that the Christian view of flourishing life will kind of rise to the top or become apparent over time. Tell us a little bit more about that wisdom test, or cast it in your own
ways. Yeah, that's a pretty good way of putting it. Well, look at it this way. the fact that everybody's having sex and marriage is declining, I think that maybe a generation ago, we would have said, if we could look ahead and say, okay, everybody's going to be having sex outside of marriage and you know, marriage is going to decline. 30 years ago, we'd have said, everybody will, it's going to create huge social consequences. I don't think we could have foreseen what's happened, which is it's actually having its main social consequences amongst non-college educated people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's decimating mm-hmm. the working class and the poor.
Says Robert mm-hmm. Putnam and Charles.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's actually works. Not decimating the educated classes for various right. reasons. So I bring that up just to say it's not always clear cut. There is this thing called common grace, and let's not debate that. Yeah. But there is such a thing as common grace. Mm-hmm. And which I think at least means God will never let the world be nearly as bad as it ought to be, considering our sin. Mm-hmm. So he's got ways of maintaining. And so I can't say it's as simple as this, but I would say that if Christians are not so shaped by the culture, if they really would be in the area of sex and gender and family, if we could somehow get a lot of evangelical Christians and a lot of Christians to live that way, I'd say 20 or 30 years from now, the outcomes are going to be obviously, they're going to be different. I think, for example, being single in a community that doesn't either overly fear marriage or overly want marriage, you know, in other words, if you're, I mean, that would, to me, would be a counterculture in, that would be a biblical counterculture when it comes to sex and marriage. In other words, being single is okay. It's not like oh, you know, unless you're married, you're nobody, which would be traditional culture. But neither is it the sort of late modern culture where you're kind of afraid of commitment. And if we kept sex inside marriage as the nurturing discipline, I do think in the long run, outcomes will be better for kids. I actually do think that there will be it'll get clearer to the overall culture that that's a good way to live. I don't know to what degree it's going to be evident. So what I usually say to people, just give us the right to live this way, and I think you will see in the long run fruit that even somebody from outside of the faith will be able to see.
I'm not sure that that's going to be very apparent when it comes to the issues of sexuality, because it seems to me that sexual issues are closer to the affections right now in our culture than almost anything else. In a way that, I mean, we look at what's happened with, we had a wisdom test with divorce, and I'm not sure that we've corrected.
Well, you're talking about inside the church.
No, I'm talking about just in terms of the culture itself, of saying this really isn't good for kids to have the families
but
breaking up.
But aren't divorce rates declining?
No. I was going to say, generally, more and more secular voices are saying it's bad for kids.
Yeah.
Right. But people are saying, tough, we don't want
right.
to go back.
They're just not getting married at all.
Exactly.
That's
well,
their response.
I would say, you know what, Russell, I would say you're still in that case. There is a wisdom contest going on then. I mean, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the culture's saying, let's get back to the Bible.
Right, right.
But I actually think that...
Or even get back to stable monogamy.
Right.
And yet, I don't know, I mean, in a way, there's a little... something is going on there where you've got secular people looking at the facts and saying, this isn't good for kids. It's almost a consensus now.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree it's not changing things. I guess I wouldn't go so far as to say the wisdom contest means that people turn back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I actually think that as time goes on, it's less laughable. The same thing's happened with, by the way, pro-life.
Yeah, oh sure. Yeah.
Just in 20 years, there's just a lot more willingness to admit that the old approach of saying it's just a piece of tissue and it's just a, you know, part of the woman's body is laughable now, because as time has gone on, especially now you're doing, you know, surgery on the child in the womb and that kind of thing, it's just getting harder and harder for, but on the other hand, I do not see a great groundswell of saying let's make abortion illegal.
Well, no, and that's why I always, evangelical exuberance about the fact that we're winning the pro-life movement makes me nervous, because evangelicals tend to look at survey results on that, which I think that the increasing numbers of pro-life people might be an indication of how secure the abortion rights regime is in America, as opposed to the fact that it's weakening, because there's not as much at stake.
Threat.
People don't... To say I'm pro-life means I'm kind of identifying with the tribe rather than I'm actually making policy that might affect me.
Right. Would you say... I'm sorry, the moderator's lost
control.
The moderator's lost control here. But I almost feel like, though, it is, in some ways, it's unmasking the freedom cultural narrative.
Sure.
It's sort of saying, you know, we really see that that is a human life.
Right.
I mean, we really can't say it's not human life.
Right.
What else would it be?
Right.
And, you know, divorce really is bad for kids, but you know what? We don't care.
Mm-hmm. I think that's
because we want to have our life the way we want to have our
life.
Right,
that's right.
That kind of unmasks it, and there are people who see that.
Yeah.
But I do agree that the because that narrative is so powerful. That's what I know what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
The cultural the narrative of individual freedom is so absolutely powerful that people are running roughshod over that.
Yeah.
But the evidence is there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I know it gives some qualms. It's what some people would call it. There is definitely are qualms on the parts of some people. They see that. And
yeah.
You see the thoughtful secular writers sometimes talking like that
right.
and saying, you know, even a guy like Nicholas Kristof,
mm-hmm.
Who will say, you know, it's kind of weird because I know this isn't what we want to see, but, you know, evangelical religion really creates heroic sacrificial love in parts of the world where... And a lot of people get upset about it, but I do feel like that's a witness.
Right.
That sort of thing is a witness, and it's a kind of factual witness of the sort of life that gospel doctrine actually creates in people's lives.
And I will agree that when it comes to the sexual issues, with the sexual issues, we are going to see a lot of refugees. From the sexual revolution, who I mean, right now the kind of language that's being used about sexuality, it reminds me a lot of Bible Belt revivalism, of the sort of testimonies that would say, if you accept Jesus, this is what your magnificent life is going to look like, which of course leaves people burned over and disappointed. And I think there are a lot of people who assume if only we expand our sexual horizons this way, now we're going to be happy, we're not going to be alienated. I don't think it can keep those promises.
Right.
Which means we have to have a church. The people who can't reach those people are going to be, on the one hand, the people who have just accommodated and thrown aside a Christian vision of sexuality, but also the people who've just been screaming at these people.
That's right.
I mean, we have to have the people who are able to actually be there and reach them at the end of all of that.
Let me, a couple of things I want to cover as well. Your context, pretty different, at least to most people you're speaking with within the SBC, but you speak outside of that as well. Is there any context in which we can properly lament the things that we're losing? I mean, you're really doing a great job of helping evangelicals to celebrate the opportunities in this changing culture, but what's the role of thinking about what's been lost with families, what's been lost with some expectations, common expectations in our culture?
I think we have lost some things, of course, but I think that most of the lament that is happening for what has been lost is not recognizing how even those good things that stabilized and kept some common grace things in were mixed in with things that were harmful
to us. It's more nostalgia than lament.
I think there's nostalgia, and I think that happens in anyone's life. As an individual gets older, you start to look with a nostalgic look to the past, and you start becoming more frantic about what's happening in the future because you don't have control over it. And I think that happens culturally, too. So, for instance, with divorce, Bible Belt Christianity kept a lot of divorces from happening, not by necessarily discipleship and discipline, but because people knew they would lose their place in the community if they divorced. Well, did that have some good effects? Sure, it did.
But if you lament it too much,
you're embracing
the toxic side of it.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You're embracing something that some of the people who were afraid to divorce in 20th century Bible Belt America were doing so from the exact same motivations that the Pharisees and the Sadducees weren't willing to confess Christ because they were afraid they would be put out of the synagogue. That's not something that we should prize as biblical motivation. So we can say that what's happening right now in our culture is going to have some bad effects in the culture and on people's lives. At the same time, it gives the church the opportunity to be the church and to reclaim some things that we should have been holding to altogether, which means a complicated view of history and a complicated view of culture. In fact, we're sinners and we live in a sinful culture, but we're not left alone here.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.